CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here are your hosts, Katie Comley and Rita Farkas.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, a new study shows organic products from Canadian farms have increased by 60%.
Criticism is mounting over the spending of a surplus at TransLink.
And on commentary, Phil Caudry takes a look at the 2008 mayoral election in Vancouver and discusses which top two issues will determine the outcome of the race.
We'll have all this, plus sports and your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next hour right here on News 101.
UBC and UVic will be going head-to-head in a green technology race this month. The universities will be sending teams to compete in the Shell Eco Marathon Americas, which brings top engineering students from North and South America together to race their fuel-efficient vehicles. Students will build prototype vehicles with three or four wheels using conventional or alternative fuels or energy sources. The team with the vehicle that travels the farthest distance using the least amount of fuel wins a grand prize of $10,000 for their school. UBC will be represented by the UBC Super Mileage team and will be opposed by the UVic H2 Drive team. This year's competitors will be vying to beat the 2007 record of 807 kilometers per liter. The competition brings together future engineers and entrepreneurs to develop innovative ideas to power the transport of tomorrow.
And up next, we're joined in studio by Radio Free UBC, and we'll allow them to introduce themselves.
Hi, and welcome to Radio Free. On today's program, we have an interview with Fatima Megji from Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights. Sam Sullivan visited campus. Jeremy Wood reports. We have a report on the bus loop petition and the BOG meeting. We talk a little bit about the UBC farm and in a picnic for them, as well as a petition. Finally, we have another interview about the AMS petition and meeting, and we'll talk a little bit about NOL aid.
So first up, I'm here with Fatima Megji. She's a active member of Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights. Last week, you guys had the Palestine Solidarity Week. What was the week, and why did you organize it?
Well, basically, it was a week just to bring about a Palestinian voice on campus, which in recent years has been quite minimal. And basically, the week consisted, we had tabling at the sub on Tuesdays and Thursday, and we also had a couple speakers that came in. We had a showing of Aren't Us Children, which is a documentary film about a bunch of children and about this Jewish woman who opens up a playhouse and their experience. And then it also follows up on the children 10 years later, and it gives really interesting insight into the conditions of them at the time. And also we had two speakers that came in. One was John Elmer, who's a photojournalist, which several of you may have heard of, and he gave a really good talk about Gaza and the situation there right now. And we also had Eva Bartlett, who's part of the International Solidarity Movement, and she gave a talk about her experience. The highlight of our week was with the author Ilan Pape, who's actually like pretty world renowned, and he's an Israeli historian. He's Jewish himself, and he lived in Israel for most of his life. His parents fled Nazi Germany, and yeah, he was teaching at the University of Haifa for about 25 years. But then when his views on Palestine and Israel itself became known, he got a bunch of death threats and he moved to England, and he's only been in England for about less than a year now. And he's written this book called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, which is his most recent book, and it brought a lot of controversy and whatnot. So he was speaking at the Vancouver Public Library, which was on Saturday, and that's also going to be available online. So for those of you that missed it, you can check out Working TV, and it should be online soon.
Yeah, so Ilan, at his talk, Ilan Pape, that was probably the biggest part of your week. He was saying we shouldn't think about the issue as a conflict. He was saying specifically we need to change our vocabulary and call it an occupation.
Yeah.
Why was he saying that?
Well, he gave some really interesting insight as to how we need to be careful of how we define things, because the way that we define things is very crucial to how we think about things. Mm-hmm. And basically what he says is that when we think about it as a conflict, it implies that there's two equal sides fighting each other. But he said that he believes that in the Palestine-Israel thing that's going on right now, there's no two equal sides, and it's basically one side taking over another. So in that sense, he said that it's not a conflict, it's an occupation. There's only one side that's being the aggressor. There's an aggressor and there's aggression. There's an occupier and there's the occupied. Mm-hmm. And he said that we really need to make our definitions distinct with that. And the other definition he brought up was the word Nakba. which means catastrophe, but he said that the word catastrophe implies that there's nobody to blame, like an earthquake or something else could be a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. So he was saying that we should use the words occupation and like use our definitions clearly so that when we define ourselves, there's no controversy about it. There's no misunderstanding about what we mean. And yeah, he basically, that was one of the advice things that he gave to different Palestinian human rights groups.
Cool. Okay, so if anyone wants to get involved with SPHR, what's the, do you have a website?
We don't have a website, but you can email us. It's sphr.ubc@gmail.com.
Okay. Thanks, Fatima.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm sure a lot of you have heard about the U Boulevard petition and the U Boulevard changes, namely the underground bus loop. There are a number of reasons that we at Radio Free oppose the underground bus loop. Economically, it's an outdated plan. The design predates the U-Pass program, so it will have limited capacity and will not accommodate ridership expansion, trolley buses, or the Millennium Line. The bus loop itself will not increase ridership or overall bus transit, and it's not related to UBC's sustainability goals. The UBC community was never meaningfully consulted on the specific issue of the underground bus loop. It's not a democratic project. The bus loop itself is going to cost over $40 million of the UBC budget. Part of this is coming from the infrastructure impacts charges. The IIC would be used for childcare, so this plan actually interferes with childcare at UBC. The UBC underground bus loop will also place significant restrictions on the sub-renew process and will delay this process potentially by at least 3 years. Finally, we at Radio Free love the Knoll, and the underground bus loop will mean the destruction of the grassy knoll. So we have a petition circulating, and the goal of the petition is to halt the construction of the underground bus loop and substitute the current plan with a public transport plan for UBC that is socially, financially, and ecologically sustainable and will attract adequate democratic support of the UBC community. So if anybody is interested, and I think this is a really important issue, we at Radio Free and the SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, are going to go talk about this issue at the next Board of Governors meeting, which is Thursday the 10th at 9 o'clock. So if anybody's interested, you can reserve tickets. They're completely free from Darlene Clark. It's darlene.clark@ubc.ca. So I hope you will do that.
Okay, up next, an interview with Jeremy Wood. Jeremy, last week, Mayor Sam Sullivan, SS, visited campus, and there was a fairly sizable protest. I mean, there were more protesters than there were basically actual people there to see Sam Sullivan. What's wrong with Sam Sullivan? I mean, doesn't he love poor people?
This is going to be really difficult without profanity. There are, let's keep the two problems about Sam Sullivan, we'll be here forever. Number one is the Civil City Initiative, which is a direct initiative from the mayor's office. And it's ostensibly aimed at curbing violence and crime in the downtown area, but it hasn't been enacted along those lines. Because, as the mayor himself said, the VPD is not accountable to the public. It's not accountable to City Hall. And the VPD has turned this policy into a policy of criminalization against the poor and ethnic cleansing. It's been turned into a policy that allows the VPD to remove anyone for what they call aggressive panhandling, but which is completely up to the jurisdiction of the officer and is essentially just panhandling from the street, from parks. It's about forbidding people to sleep in parks and making it increasingly impossible to survive as a homeless person. And the second reason we oppose Sam Sullivan is that poverty has become so much more common under him. Poverty has increased exponentially under Sam Sullivan. And Sam Sullivan will claim that there have been 1,200 SRO, single-room occupancy units, built under his jurisdiction. That number itself is denied by many community groups. And beyond that, more than 800 have closed in that time. So if Sam Sullivan's predictions are even close to right, then it's a balancing out. It's not an increase in rooms, but it's most likely Yeah. An increase in poverty.
So what are people doing, like, right now in the downtown east side to compensate for the fact that the mayor and the municipality is basically coming up short on all these issues? What are some of the grassroots initiatives or movements?
There's been amazing coalition building. There's been amazing grassroots uprisings against these policies. People are angry. People who are being affected by these are angry. Some of the groups involved are DERA, which is the Downtown Eastside Residents Association, the APC, the Anti-Poverty Coalition. And there are many different directives are being taken, some that are closer to direct action, some that are more cooperative with the processes of electoral politics, some that are taking a more Aboriginal angle, some that are looking at the effect of the 2010 Winter Games on these. But there is an amazing swell of resistance, and they can use all the support they can get. And SDS is proud to fight with them.
All right, cool. Thanks, Jeremy. That's awesome. Okay, so finally, we're just going to talk about what's been called recently the major scandal in the AMS. Recently, the vice president of the AMS was elected, and he won the race by 25 votes. 2 weeks after the vice president was elected, it turned out that he voted for himself multiple times. As a result, the vice president was taken to student court, an independent body made up of law students, and student court subsequently ruled that it's illegal to vote for yourself multiple times and that therefore the vice president, Alex Lougheed, should be disqualified immediately. Unfortunately, because Alex Lougheed is the vice president and he's in government with many supporters and friends, government concentrated power in itself and decided to rule that the student court is not a court at all, but an advisory body. And therefore, Vice President Alex Lougheed is allowed to stay as a representative of students. Unfortunately, many students disagree that someone who has been ruled as disqualified should continue to represent them as vice president. So we've circulated a petition called the Petition for Immediate By-Election in the AMS. If you want access to the petition, you can email ams.petition@gmail.com. And the petition is just very simple, and it calls for AMS Council to accept the ruling of student court and hold an immediate by-election. So make sure you find out about that. And if you want to have your voice heard, you should show up at the Student Government Council meeting this Wednesday at 6 p.m. in the council chambers upstairs in the Student Union building, where there will be free food. And so come and eat and make your voice heard.
So speaking of free food, we're having a NOLAID 2.0 today. So everybody should come out, hear some great free bands, eat some delicious free food, and have a great time. And sign some petitions. Yeah.
And thanks, as always, to Radio Free UBC for their piece this week. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but when we return, we'll bring you some local and provincial news.
William Shatner. Imagine a children's hospital network that boldly goes where none have gone before, and that's Shriners Hospitals for Children. Shriners Hospitals combine state-of-the-art research and teaching programs with world-class orthopedic burn, spinal cord injury, and cleft lip and palate medical care. At Shriners, tomorrow's medical care is here today. Call 1-800-361-7256 for more information. Shriners, having fun and helping kids.
It's 5:25, and welcome back to CITR. Now with a look at local and provincial news, joining us in the studio are News 101 reporters Leanne Yu and Carrie Baptist. Marie Bernard.
The District 319 Theater on Main Street in the heart of the downtown East Side is getting a liquor license, even though there's a moratorium on new licenses in the downtown East Side. The theater used to be called the Golden Harvest and has an international film production company next door. District 319 will be allowed to serve alcohol at screenings, seminars, and other events. Vancouver City Council made the decision in hopes of cleaning up the area by creating a hub for cultural events.
TransLink is reporting a large surplus of $87 million for last year. The Transit Authority now has an accumulated budget surplus of $403 million. However, Chair of the TransLink Board of Directors, Dale Parker, says that this surplus money is already spoken for to finance the continuing TransLink expansions or to pay for the next round of transit improvements, including road improvements. Currently, revenue is still outpacing the rising costs of transportation because with the rising cost of gas, more riders are buying two and three zone passes. NDP Surrey Wally MLA Bruce Walston says that this surplus revenue means TransLink should roll back the transit fare increase that went into effect last January.
And a surgeon at Royal Columbian Hospital is calling out to the Fraser Health Authority for an increase in resources. Dr. Rob Granger says major elective surgeries at the hospital are being cancelled on a daily basis, and patients are being left sitting in the hallway waiting for nursing care. Granger, a doctor in his eighth year at Royal Columbian, stresses the hospital is in a crisis due to years of financial neglect and no significant improvements in infrastructure. In a letter submitted last month, Granger suggested surgeons no longer have departmental surgical operating room time. Instead, all OR time should be put in a pool and doctors should only do emergency procedures. NDP oppositional health critic Adrian Dix accuses Health Minister George Abbott of repeatedly ignoring calls from hospital staff. But Abbott denies the facility is in a crisis. He says the hospital is undersized for current volumes and that Fraser Health is looking into strategic investments to increase capacity.
And before we go on to provincial and national news, we're going to take another quick PSA break, but stay tuned to CITR for more news.
Want to see your film up on the big screen?
The Vancouver Student Film Festival is back to showcase the best of BC's post-secondary student and alumni film and video makers on May 24th.
The film festival is looking for entries of all genres, from student or graduate filmmakers within the last 3 years. Films received by March 1st are only $10 and $20 until April 19th.
Only 2 weeks left before the early entry deadline. For entry rules and to submit online, please visit www.vsff.com.
Let the cartoons begin!
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro. And I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pit my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Thunderstorms, see the lightning flashing, thunderstorms.
Thank you for stopping that. If you actually want to learn more about weather, join the UBC Storm Club. For more information, email us at stormubc@gmail.com. Stop playing those cheesy songs and tune into News 101 Mondays and Fridays for your CITR weather forecast.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:30 p.m. A new study from Statistics Canada shows that within the last 5 years, the number of farms in British Columbia producing certified organic products has increased by 40%. Statistics Canada's study was aptly titled Organic, From Niche to Mainstream. It also showed that in Canada as a whole, there has been a 60% increase in farms producing certified organic products, up from 2,230 farms in 2001 to 3,555 in 2006, with an additional 640 farms still in transition. In British Columbia alone, there were 133 more certified organic farms compared to 2001. As a result of the dramatic increase, members of the BC's Legislative Assembly met with Canadian Health Food Association, or CHFA. The CHFA was hosting Expo West, which is Western Canada's largest natural health products and organized organics trade show and conference. With more on this story, here's Tracy Fuller.
Penelope Merritt, CEO of the Canadian Health Food Association, says the study, in addition to surveys and member feedback, demonstrates a growing demand for natural health products and organics. She also thinks that Canadians want to play an important role in improving and maintaining their own health and well-being, and that they can achieve this with the help of natural health products and organics. The 2008 CHFA Expo West Conference and Trade Show runs from April 3rd to April 6th at the Vancouver Convention and Exhibition Center, and it is the place to learn about new trends and developments in Canada's natural health products and organic industries. For more information about Expo West and the NHP and organics industries, visit www.chfa.ca.
On a rather grim note for post-secondary education, funding has been cut across the province, and it's the educators who will be left with the short end of the stick. An unspecified number of college and university instructors are expected to be laid off this week. President of the Federation of Post-Secondary Educators, Cindy Oliver, says the funding cut has blindsided the post-secondary community. The cuts were not expected, and they are still not understood. One of the hardest hit institutions in BC is Vancouver Community College. 36 faculty members are being laid off. Estimates of 1,000 student placements are being eliminated. This after Advanced Education Minister Murray Cole cut overall funding by 2.6% and reduced student placements. No school is exempt from these changes. NDP critic Rob Fleming says the cuts and layoffs don't make sense when the economy is strong and the province is in a surplus. He's urging Cole to restore full funding immediately, especially because at present there is a critical shortage of skilled labor in British Columbia.
Smoking is down and obesity is up in BC high schools. According to Provincial Health Officer Dr. Perry Kendall, the number of students in BC schools who smoke cigarettes or marijuana or drink alcohol is fewer than ever before. However, the number of students suffering from obesity, cyberbullying, STDs, and anxiety disorders has increased. The report by the province recommends a new evaluation of whether health promotion school programs are working, including a responsible decision-making course for grade 12 students, as well as a program to increase early learning opportunities for at-risk students.
According to local physicians, 5% of babies in Prince George are born with drug addictions. These drug-addicted newborns suffer everything from drug withdrawal to kidney failure, strokes, and heart attacks. Many have to be treated with morphine just to make their lives bearable. The vice president of medical staff at Prince George Regional Hospital, Dr. Marie Hay, says she is alarmed by the increase in the number of drug-damaged newborns. Hay said that when she started in the region, fetal alcohol syndrome was an epidemic, but now the number of babies born addicted to drugs is 5 times greater than those affected by alcohol. Hay suggests that some of the $10 million the provincial government recently allocated to fight fetal alcohol syndrome should be diverted to help pregnant women fight their drug addictions.
And we're going to take another break now, but when we come back, we'll update you on national and international news. Stay with us. News 101 will continue right after this.
Want to see your film up on the big screen?
The Vancouver Student Film Festival is back to showcase the best of BC's post-secondary student and alumni film and video makers on May 24th.
The film festival is looking for entries of all genres, from student or graduate filmmakers within the last 3 years. Films received by March 1st are only $10 and $20 until April 19th.
Only 2 weeks left before the early entry deadline. For entry rules and to submit online, please visit www.vsff.com.
Let the cartoons begin!
The Leo Ramirez Show. The best mix of Latin American music, news, sport, and commentary from around the local and international Latin American communities. Saturday, 5 to 6 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. El show de Leo Ramirez. La mejor mezcla de música, noticias, deportes y comentarios de la comunidad latinoamericana. Sábado de 5 a 6 de la tarde en el 101.9 FM CITR.
.536 and the news continues on CITR. In a new ruling, Air Canada must allow passengers to take their pets on board domestic and international flights. Last summer, the airline said passengers could no longer transport their cats, dogs, and other small pets as checked baggage. This was to increase space for luggage. Instead, pets had to travel separately aboard cargo planes. But today, the Canadian Air Transportation Agency ruled the airline has until May 5th to fulfill the new policy. Animals are to be allowed on all flights as long as the pet and its crate total a combined weight of less than 31 kilograms. The agency says that Air Canada policy was unreasonable. It favored the company while putting pets in possible danger. The investigation stemmed from a complaint by a passenger who felt that the policy would cause inconvenience to people traveling with pets, especially in terms of cost. Peter Griffiths said the fee would be charged would be more than double from the $105 to $220 each way for his 6-kilogram dog. He felt the sole purpose of the animal ban was financial gain for Air Canada in a very lucrative cargo market. And in international news, FSRN brings us a story now on the attack of African refugees by Egyptian forces.
Amnesty International is calling for a probe into killings by Egyptian border guards of African refugees trying to enter Israel. 10 have been shot dead since the start of the year, including 2 from the Ivory Coast 1 week ago. About 5,500 African asylum seekers crossed into Israel from Sinai last year and 2,200 in the past 3 months. Despite the threat of deadly force by Egyptian security, Zach Badarf reports from Tel Aviv on what the UN Refugee Agency calls a crisis situation.
Just outside Tel Aviv's central bus station in Levinsky Park, about 40 refugees living in Israel sit and wait. They're from Eritrea, Sudan, Ghana, and elsewhere in the continent south of the Suez Canal. 22-year-old Hamed is from the Ivory Coast. Back home, he says his father was killed there, and he doesn't know why, but he feared the same would happen to him, so he fled. He snuck across the 160-mile-wide Israel-Egypt border about a month ago. His family spent about $3,000 to get him through Mali, Mauritania, and Egypt to the Promised Land, Israel. After traveling with the smuggler for 3 days by car and on foot to reach the Sinai border, he heard a gunshot in the desert. He ran and hid with the smuggler.
I was thinking at that scene, maybe there's an Egyptian. Do you want to kill me or not? Yeah.
Hamed says instead of being shot, he was detained by Israeli soldiers and later released into Israel. He says he heard many stories about Egyptian border guards killing potential asylum seekers crossing into Israel.
We are the African. We didn't let the idea. We are it. Because something that if you are shooting people, the black, the African, Egypt is an African country. That is good to get, catch the people and return them back to different countries, but not to shoot them. Really, we are very sorry for that.
The UN estimates there are 7,000 African refugees like Hamed in Israel. Amnesty International says Tel Aviv has put increased pressure on Cairo to reduce the flow of people crossing illegally. Ilan Lonai, the director of activism and campaigns for Amnesty's Tel Aviv office, says the result has been the disproportionate use of force by Egypt's border guards.
When somebody's asked to stop and he's not threatening you, there's no reason in the world to shoot him, especially people who are running away from you. There are different ways of stopping them.
Lonai says Israel should not be using Egypt to stop people from entering that need protection.
This is a very sad issue. In a country that has built itself on this notion of protecting refugees, to so easily forget all of our history and push it all away, this is a very, very sad issue.
Describing the refugee influx as a tsunami that could grow, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert last month ordered the immediate deportation of illegal infiltrators. But refugees from Sudan and Eritrea will have their cases reviewed. Israel insists that it will not be bound by UN recommendations on whether it's safe for the refugees to return home. Last August, a group of 48 asylum seekers was returned to Egypt, which then sent them back to Sudan. Human Rights Watch says execution and lengthy prison terms await those who return home. Chevy Corzin, the executive director of the Tel Aviv-based Hotline for Migrant Workers, says the main problem is Israel doesn't have an established system in place to manage the incoming refugees.
It seems that the reactions are sort of a panic reactions, but in the long run, obviously, this can't work. In the long run, Israel has to accept the fact that it has become, like other countries, a country that accepts asylum seekers. It's not the only one. It seems to think so, but it's not. And it needs to be able to handle this in accordance to its obligations to international law, to the Refugee Convention, which Israel was the first country to sign and to promote.
Since Israel is considered a developed nation, the UN Refugee Agency doesn't provide assistance to asylum seekers like food or shelter, but neither does the State of Israel. Corzin said, in theory, African refugees have basic rights in Israel, but are not treated equally by society.
But when the government either leaves people in a state where they have no visas, so they cannot work and they cannot support themselves on the one hand, and they're not being given any shelter or humanitarian assistance, and then they're being targeted and arrested and being placed in detention for many, many months, then these are the kind of actions that I think altogether, certainly you could say, marginalizes people and puts them in a state where their rights are violated.
As for Hamed, he made his way to Tel Aviv and registered with the UN and Israeli officials. His status and future are unknown, at least to him. For now, he waits with the other African refugees in Levinsky Park.
Every day I come and sit down here. I'm willing to work, but you see, if you don't have a visa, you don't work. What I have to do? I have to be patient to wait for that anymore because I cannot do anything. I don't have any opportunity. Different means to do it.
An estimated 7,000 African refugees live in Israel, with 2,600 in Tel Aviv alone. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Badorf in Tel Aviv.
And thanks as always to FSRN for making that piece available for rebroadcast. On a lighter note, it's International Pay It Forward Day. If you've never heard the term, it's when someone does something for you, and rather than paying them back, you pay it forward by doing something nice for someone else. Similar to Random Acts of Kindness Week, Pay It Forward Day requires random acts of kindness without expecting anything in return. Based on the book and a Hollywood movie, people are asked to perform three acts of kindness and ask the receivers to pay it forward to three more people. Those three people will do deeds for three more people and so on. This is the first time Pay It Forward is reaching Canada after huge success in Australia last year. For more information on the event and the Pay It Forward phenomenon, visit payitforwardday.com and payitforwardfoundation.org.
It's now time for commentary, and this week, Phil takes a look at the top two issues that will determine the 2008 mayoral election in Vancouver.
The hotly contested mayoral race in Vancouver this year has arguably one of the most crowded fields of qualified candidates in years. On the MPA side, Mayor Sam Sullivan and City Councillor Peter Ladner are running. On Vision Vancouver's side, Raymond Louis, Gregor Robertson, and Alan DiGianova are running. Cope's David Cadman, who ran in the previous election, is also a possibility to run. Regardless of one's political ideology, there's no doubt that there's a lot of talent running in the Vancouver mayoral election. Within Vision Vancouver, there's a variety of left-leaning policymakers to choose from. Within the MPA, there are two accomplished fiscal conservatives running. However, even with the wealth of talent in the current crop of candidates, it could go all to waste if Vancouver's two top issues are not addressed, being eco-density and crime. Eco-density has been marred with controversy since Sam Sullivan attempted to copyright the term. It's an issue that is inevitable with the environmental concerns, a population crunch in the Lower Mainland, and skyrocketing real estate prices. The supply of eco-friendly real estate simply does not meet the demand. However, it's up to the government to meet this demand because they control zoning in the city and thus control densification. Eco-density is currently in its infant stages, as consultations are currently taking place with different communities in Vancouver to see how to effectively move forward with densifying the city and implementing it over the years. The next mayor needs to set a clear vision on how to achieve eco-density and set a realistic time frame. Inclusivity will be vital to achieve a more environmentally sound city. But more importantly, all areas of Vancouver needs to be densified, whether it's the downtown east side or Shaughnessy. Vancouver cannot live by the development rule that everyone's equal, but some people are more equal than others. Everyone needs to be equal, and we need to densify across the whole city. While the next mayor has a challenge ahead of himself to bring all communities together to decide exactly how to implement a more sustainable and densified Vancouver, the infrastructure invested by the province and federal government is a good first step to do this. This infrastructure has set the foundation, with public transportation being the keystone of this investment. The next mayor needs to seize this opportunity and take leadership on urban development and set an example for the rest of Canada's urban centres. Another issue that is hugely contentious for Vancouverites is crime. Shootings and deaths associated with them are at an all-time high. To compound matters, the shootings are taking place in all areas of Vancouver. This is an epidemic and an issue that affects all residents of the city. Vancouver simply does not have enough law enforcement officers to enforce the law. Sam Sullivan has proposed increasing the police forces, and other candidates have to take his lead and come up with a blueprint for determining how to stop the epidemic of violent crime in the city. Another issue that needs to be addressed is the Vancouver Police Department's controversial relationship with residents of the downtown east side. While the new Police Commissioner Jim Chu has taken steps in order to reconcile this relationship by issuing a statement saying that the Vancouver Police Department regrets its actions. This is only a first step, and the Vancouver Police Department needs more transparency in terms of how it treats Vancouverites. We can only trust the Vancouver Police Department reducing crime when we can trust them ourselves. While the 2008 mayoral election is still in its infant stages, and most candidates have not released policy on these two issues, I'll be looking for them to take leadership on crime and eco-density in order to make an endorsement. For News 101 Commentary, I'm Phil Caudry.
And thanks, as always, to Phil for that piece. Our producer, Carrie Baptist, is here now with a look at the oddity of the week. Carrie, I hear you have a story on an unusual hideout for a burglar.
Yes. Police in Burjassot, Spain, made a surprising discovery while investigating a suspicious noise complaint at the Crespo funeral home on Wednesday. Neighbors alerted police that they suspected criminal activity at the funeral home when they heard the front door of the business being forced open in the middle of the night. When police arrived, they found a 23-year-old man lying on a table in a glassed-in chamber, which is normally used for viewing deceased people during wakes. Apparently, the suspect had attempted to feign death to avoid being charged for breaking and entering. Police say two details tipped them off to the fact that the man on the table was still living. Firstly, he was still breathing. And secondly, he was wearing casual clothes that were wrinkled and dirty, not the typical formal attire of those dressed for their eternal slumber. The would-be deceased man was arrested and is currently being held by police, and owners of the funeral home are mystified as to why the man would break into their location because the building contained no cash or valuables. So what do you guys think about that?
I don't know. It's pretty creative, but...
It is puzzling why he would go to a funeral home.
I guess I can understand because funeral homes are big business. Coffins are worth thousands of dollars on their own, depending on what you get, if it's oak or marble. Those things cost a lot of money.
Do you think there's a black market for something like that?
I think there might be a black market. I know the average funeral is like tens of thousands of dollars.
Those are heavy, though. One man breaking into a house, could he really carry away a whole coffin? easily?
I think we have a theme because whenever we've covered sort of odd crimes, it's always something original, right? And maybe that's the key in the market of crimes is like you have to do something that hasn't been done, maybe, right?
Maybe he was trying
to find a niche, right?
Yeah, he just wanted to get famous, and this is his 15 minutes of fame.
Maybe he has some sort of greater social comment that we're just missing by this whole act.
Well, either way, it's kind of like, I don't think it's probably bad karma, right? I don't think you're supposed to pretend you're dead you want to die.
That is definitely
kind of thing
karma.
Your mom would say, never cry wolf or something, right?
Or it's like, don't make ugly faces because your face will stick that
right,
way.
Right, exactly. Okay.
Don't jump into coffins because you might end up being dead. I'm confused, but thank you very much, Carrie. It was a lovely oddity. And it's a quick break, but coming up next, it's UBC Sports with Tyler Noble. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The UBC Ski and Snowboard Club is a non-profit, democratic, student-run organization dedicated to promoting the sports of skiing and snowboarding and the associated lifestyle.
We endeavor to make skiing and snowboarding accessible and fun by actively seeking out the best deals and discounts for our members, as well as organizing trips to local ski areas and setting up numerous social events.
Come on one of our legendary trips and explore the glory of riding in British Columbia. Or join us at the bar to discover the true meaning of debauchery. Ask your roommate, ask your parents, ask the RCMP. Who has the most fun at UBC? You'll get the same answer. The Ski and Snowboard Club.
Yeah. Joining the Ski and Board Club is easy. Come by our office, sub 115, anytime with some money to become a member. Your membership gives you access to all the deals offered by our sponsors, cheap beverages at our parties, an invitation to all club events, and of course, only members can come on the trips. Yeah.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR. I'm Katie Comley alongside Rita Farkas coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Right now it's 5:52 p.m. and time to turn things over to Thunderbird Ion Sports with Tyler Noble.
All right, thanks very much, Rita. A capacity crowd of over 800 UBC Thunderbirds athletes, coaches, and alumni gathered at the Hyatt Regency Hotel on Wednesday night to recognize the most outstanding athletes and teams of the 2007-08 academic year at what they call the annual Big Block Awards. It was certainly a good year for UBC athletics, with three teams winning CIS championships and several others also making nationals. The major winners include for the Bobby Gall Award for the Most Outstanding Graduating Male Athlete. Co-winners this year, Michael Elliott from men's soccer and Anthony Wright from men's field hockey. The Mae Brown Award for the Most Outstanding Graduating Female Athlete. This one, pretty well a slam dunk for Erica McGinnis. She was lights out at the Nationals in Saskatoon en route to a UBC victory. The Bus Phillips Award for the Most Outstanding Male Athlete. That goes to UBC's Mike Mason from track and field. The Marilyn Pomfrey Award for the Most Outstanding Female Athlete, that goes to Anna Mae Pierce from swimming. They picked up a national championship once again this year. The Du Vivier Award for Team of the Year co-winners, and no surprise here, women's volleyball and women's basketball, both of which claimed national championships last month. Men's Rookie of the Year goes to Jorge Engalmira from the men's soccer team. He was great at the Nationals hosted by UBC this past fall. And the Women's Rookie of the Year, also from soccer, that being Natalie Hirayama. Despite suffering their first loss of the season in conference play last weekend against the College of Idaho, the UBC Thunderbirds baseball team managed to put even more distance between themselves and the second-place Yotes by taking 2 of 3 at Nat Bailey Stadium to improve to 10-1 and take a 3.5-game lead in the NAIA Region 1 standings. The Birds have another key matchup to look forward to this weekend as they take on the Concordia Cavaliers, who are just a half-game back of the Yotes in the standings. Mike Sterna and John Chernick are sporting batting averages of .429 and .417 respectively to lead the Birds on offense. Ben Torrey, he isn't far behind either. He's hitting .368 on the year so far. UBC will be without their usual leadoff man, however, as Sammy Starr will remain sidelined this weekend with a hip flexor injury. injury rather, and on the mound, second-year southpaw Mark Hardy continues to be UBC's go-to guy. He picked up his fourth complete game and third shutout of the season last weekend against Idaho. He currently boasts a perfect 4-0 record with a sparkling 0.96 earned runs average. UBC is 4-0 against Concordia so far this season. The teams are scheduled to do battle at 12 noon and 2:30 p.m. tomorrow, and then again on Sunday at 11 a.m. and 2 o'clock. And just like all other home games, you can catch the action on the web at gothunderbirds.ca, weather permitting, of course. Speaking of which, weather hampered UBC's efforts in their season opener at the University of Washington last weekend, this being track and field. With winds gusting and rain falling and the temperature hanging around zero throughout, Sean McIsaac threw 50.86 meters in the hammer throw to make A standard and improve his qualification mark for the NAIA National Championships coming up in late May. Other powerful throws were made by Lana Turlak, who won the women's hammer throw, and Ella Johnstone, who threw 38.16 meters to win the javelin event. Other strong finishes include Reed Gustafson's new personal best of 4.25 meters in the pole vault, and by steeplechase runners Will Stewart and Jordan Maynard, who finished a second apart to place second and third, respectively. Track and field season continues tomorrow at SFU as both the men's and women's teams look to improve upon their previous performances. The Simon Fraser Open gets underway with the 3-kilometer race walk kicking things off at around 1 o'clock. Swimming superstar Brian Johns is off to compete against the world yet again. The most decorated athlete in CIS history with 33 golds and 1 silver in 34 races. Johns finished second in the 400 individual medley at the CN swimming trials to qualify for his third Olympic Games. His time of 4:17.81 was just off the winning time of 4:16.98, but was more than enough to punch his ticket to Beijing this summer. Johns says his biggest expectation at the Olympics is to put together his greatest swim there, especially since this is his third go around. He made his Olympic debut, of course, 8 years ago in Sydney, Australia. Other action this weekend, men's rugby taking on Abbotsford RFC tomorrow out in the Valley, and women's golf is at Cal State Northridge coming up on Monday. And just very quickly, Katie, I want to offer my congratulations to a fellow CITR sports member who is gearing up for a big assignment with CBC's Hockey Night in Canada. Yes, Jason Wang, who's been with us at CITR for a number of years, doing just about everything from basketball to volleyball, a little bit of hockey, and plenty more behind the scenes. We'll be calling NHL playoff games in Mandarin on the web at cbcsports.ca. Now, Jason would have been covering the Canucks had they not gone on their big tailspin recently to fall out of the playoff picture, so we're not sure yet which series he'll be doing instead, perhaps the Calgary Flames and whoever they play. But very cool nonetheless. Jason actually was born in Taipei and speaks fluent Mandarin, and was the Mandarin play-by-play voice for the Vancouver Whitecaps home games last season on the web and on the Shaw Multicultural Channel, so be sure to check that out, especially if you understand Mandarin, Katie.
I feel disappointed that I can't understand Mandarin, but congratulations to Jason. That's an amazing opportunity, and here at News 101, we wish him all the best. He's been a great contributor. So
yeah, certainly from a sports director's point of view, it's always warming to see our crew move on and do other great things. So
one of our own go off in the world and do something great. Thanks very much, Tyler. And before we go tonight, we're going to check in with our meteorologist, Selena Ferris, for a look at your weekend weather. Selena?
Two-week systems will be moving into the area over the next few days. Tonight will remain cloudy with a low down to 4 degrees. Saturday will also remain cloudy with some scattered showers in the afternoon, and they will continue overnight, a high of 7 degrees and a low down to 5. Sunday will warm up a bit with a high of 10 degrees and a few scattered showers throughout the day. Monday may see a glimpse of sunshine, but will still remain mostly cloudy with a 30% chance of showers. The rest of the week will look mostly the same, cloudy with the odd rain shower. That's your weekend weather brought to you by the Storm Club at UBC. For more information, you can email us at stormubc@gmail.com.
And thank you, Selena, for teeing us off for this weekend's weather. That's our program for April 4th, 2008. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca.
The lovely and talented Carrie Baptist produced this radio program.
For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Katie Comley.
And I'm Rita Fargus. Thanks for listening. Coming up next, more locally produced independent radio. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.